Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, we just talked about some of the headlines that are out there. Pfizer and BioNTech starting a study of a COVID-19 vaccine targeting Omicron. To me, that kind of is a little late in my view, but I'm not an expert, Tim.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. I think something similar with the regards to, you know, people starting to get certain types of masks now and then those home test kits that are being sent to them as well.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah. Better late than never, though.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's true. Let's get into it with Dr. Harold Paas. He's Executive Vice President for Health Sciences over at Stony Brook University, former Chancellor for Health Affairs at The Ohio State University and CEO of Wexner Medical Center. He's also former Chief Medical Officer at Aetna. He comes at this from such a great vantage point. Dr. Paas back with us on the phone from Stony Brook, New York. Dr. Paas, nice to have you here with Tim and myself. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. Good to be with both of you.
Well, it's good to have you here. There are a lot of headlines, as always, that are thrown back at us. We are increasingly seeing it, you know, once again, political when it comes to not having to wear masks. We're seeing different things in New York and elsewhere. What's first and foremost when you want to have a conversation about COVID right now?
Well, I think, first of all, we are seeing cases down 75% statewide in New York since the Omicron peak, and the positivity rate is down to about 12% from over 22% just since January 5th. So that's a positive sign. And as I think everyone has heard, the East Coast, New York in particular, has led that decline, and we remain very hopeful that the rest of the nation will continue to follow in short order. That's really, really important. And we're seeing that on Long Island as well. The numbers are going down.
So with that background and the headline that Carol shared that Pfizer and BioNTech have started this trial of an Omicron-specific vaccine, does it seem like it's too late for that because of the way that we've seen variants from the Alpha to the Delta to the Omicron and all those in between move, or does it kind of make sense?
Yeah.
Or does it kind of make sense? Like, help us understand why this is why these companies would want to do that.
So, you know, we're going to continue to see variants, I believe, of the COVID 19 virus, and as such, we know, for example, that three shots of the vaccine today of these mRNA vaccines are protective. In large part, particularly as it has to do with hospitalization and severe illness. You know, when we're in our Stony Brook University Hospital, the patients that we see hospitalized are the ones that are not vaccinated, or if they have had all three vaccines, they have severe underlying immunocompromising illnesses, such as a transplant or severe underlying cancer, something of that sort. But for the general population, these vaccines, three of them together, have offered significant protection. Now, it doesn't mean that people are being prevented from contracting the virus, having a mild illness. But the important thing is that we're keeping everything, that we do everything we can to keep people out of the hospital, and even more importantly than that, keeping them out of the ICU and off the ventilators and preventing their death. That's what we hope for from these vaccines. As variants come forward in the future, and inevitably there will be more variants, all these viruses vary. We see that with influenza each year.
Right.
Having new vaccines available to address that's going to be important. And I think clinical studies will tell us how effective this newest vaccine will be in preventing either this variant, the Omicron variant, or something that follows it in the future. You know, we talk about someone getting a third or a fourth booster. I like to think about it this way, and this is how I explain it to family and friends. Every year I go get a flu shot because the flu virus, the influenza virus, has variants. It transforms itself each year. I've lost count as to the number of times I've received a flu shot each fall, but I go get one because I believe it'll help prevent me, maybe not from contracting the flu, but from getting severely sick with the flu and winding up in the hospital. And I think that's where we're headed, in my opinion, with COVID-19. You know, early on, many of us had hoped we could eradicate this. We could stop it in its tracks as a global pandemic. In fact, in all likelihood, as I think about it, it will be something that we will contend with. But the goal is to reduce it to clusters so that it's not a pandemic. And most importantly, we can protect the population from wind up becoming critically ill and from wind up being hospitalized and dying. That should be our focus and our goal. And when these things do come along, we take appropriate measures to protect the community. Social distancing, wearing a mask that's effective so that we can reduce the spread and avoid getting other people sick. Because some people, as I said earlier, because of a severe underlying disease, may not get the full benefit of the vaccine to protect them.
Right, and we still have to think about this, though, in terms of global initiatives and hoping everybody's kind of on the same page about this. Dr. Paws, thank you so much. Really appreciate it, and the best to you. Dr. Harold Paws, he's Executive VP for Health Sciences over at Stony Brook University, joining us once again on the phone from Stony Brook, New York. I mean, we know so much more than we did at the start of this, no doubt about it.
We do. And I think, to a certain extent, you know, he talks about the cases being down in New York City. Just earlier today, Carol, we learned that Bank of America is bringing its staff back to the offices as COVID cases are decreasing. The question is, who follows, right?
Right, exactly.
Banks are one thing, but does everyone come back? Probably not.
I don't know. But it feels like this cycle went fairly quickly versus some of our past cycles.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
The pandemic. All right, more to come right here on Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Earlier today, we got one from the Biden administration concluding that a global semiconductor shortage will persist until at least the second half of this year, promising long-term strain on a range of U.S. businesses, including automakers and the consumer electronics industry. And then you had NVIDIA, Tim, said to be quietly preparing to abandon its $40 billion deal to buy ARM from SoftBank, according to those in the know.
Yeah, that story from our own Ian King and others. He is U.S. semiconductor and networking reporter here at Bloomberg News. Shares of NVIDIA, by the way, down about 3.2% right now. Ian King joins us now. Ian, how are you? Hey, Ian, I want to make sure you're with us, but I do want to ask all about the story that you wrote along with our colleagues, Giles Turner and Peter Elstrom, about NVIDIA's said to prepare to abandon that $40 billion ARM deal. And as a result, shares of NVIDIA are lower. What can you tell us?
Well, I think, you know, we have to be a little bit careful here. There are lots of puts and takes. There are competing voices, as we said in the story, both inside NVIDIA and in SoftBank. So we're not saying that, you know, they're going to come out tomorrow and say this is over. But according to our reporting, there appears to be an acknowledgement and a preparation for this not to get through this very difficult approval process around the world in terms of regulators. And you remember from day one that, you know, everybody was like, yeah, from a business perspective, this deal kind of makes sense, but really, are they are regulators going to allow this to happen? So, you know, the story, if there's a bottom line to it, would be to sort of say that, you know, our reporting shows that there's kind of an acknowledgement of that coming within some aspects of these companies.
You know, there's a lot going on in the semiconductor industry and, you know, the Biden administration coming out. Where are we in terms of cycles and companies ramping up? We hear a lot about big spends from Intel and the light and others. Ian, so how do you kind of see some of the longer term story threads that might play out this year?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the report that came out from the Commerce Department, you know, the background to this is that the administration and politicians in general have been like, look, we need to do something about this. This is terrible for, you know, the automotive industry in general. What's going on? We need to get to the bottom of this. They did this huge survey, this huge look into the supply chain to look for areas that they might be able to intervene in and make things better. Unfortunately, the conclusion that they've sort of come up with is really one that the industry has sort of been telling them all along, which is nothing gets better until at the earliest the second half of this year, mm-hmm. and largely, you know, for many industries, until we'll have to wait until next year before we get the level of supply that we've needed. So it's a little bit disappointing in general, but for those who cover the chip industry, not that surprising.
So what does that mean for consumers and for consumers who are trying to understand why prices of autos are higher or why they're having trouble getting their hands on certain goods?
Yeah, I mean, it's back to this sort of conflation of long-term and short-term aspects of the chip industry that we're talking about. I mean, you've got a short-term, you know, demand spike caused by various things. And at the same time, we've got the reality of the inertia of the chip industry, which is that even at the very beginning of this crisis, if everybody had gone out and started digging holes in the ground and building plants, those plants wouldn't be online right now. And in reality, right. We've got companies like Intel last week saying, hey, we're going to expand into Ohio. And everybody goes, oh, that's fantastic. They're spending $20 billion. But those plants won't come online until, you know, 2025. So short term, there's nobody riding to the rescue here.
Ian, really quickly, 20 seconds, with the NVIDIA and ARM, does something else happen? Does somebody else come in and look at ARM, or can they? Is there any other kind of consolidation or moves that you're watching just closely,
yeah,
real quickly?
I mean, plan B here, as we've said all along, has been that SoftBank tries to get out of this asset and get a return by doing an IPO.
Ah, okay. So we'll watch for that. Thank you. I know it's a busy day. Lots going on, including Texas Instruments after the close. But Ian's always there for us. Ian King, U.S. Semiconductor Networking Reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from our San Francisco Bureau. Important space.
Important space. Also, Intel tomorrow.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
So he's a little bitty.
He's a little busy. Thanks, Ian, for coming on.
I bet he's got a cot, like, you know, on the side at that San Francisco Bureau.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses like yours effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Throughout the pandemic, now in its third year, we all, I think it's safe to say, have a story about access to testing, Tim, right? We all have one of trying to get the test, buy the test, keep on top of it. That's the focus of the forthcoming remarks in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine.
Those remarks written by Emma Court and Cynthia Kunz. Joining us now is Cynthia Kunz, U.S. healthcare reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from New Jersey. Also with us is Joel Weber, editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us on the access line from Brooklyn. Joel, this is a question I've been asking myself over the last, probably 8 weeks specifically, as the Omicron variant has surged and subsequently fallen here in New York City. Why is the United States still far behind when it comes to testing? Like, it really feels like we're playing catch up.
Yeah, well, it's a question that we're going to let Cynthia answer, but I'll stretch it a little bit longer. Because you're right, like Omicron obviously made it another question that that we just couldn't stop asking. And, you know, Carol, there at the top, like here we are knocking on the door of 2 years of this. And really, America is almost like we were in the first 6 months where we really haven't made as much progress on the testing front as you would have expected. And yet we have vaccines in record time. And so the question that we sort of went to Cynthia with was like, look, like Operation Warp Speed, that worked. We got results. We got, you know, vaccines. But like, you know, we still are kind of where we started with testing. What would like an Operation Warp Speed for testing look like? And that there is sort of a nuanced answer. But, you know, there is maybe some hope there. Right, Cynthia?
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like the one thing testing needs is not warp speed, but really this, what we've heard from everyone involved in it is really a long-term commitment and investment, something that the U.S. government hasn't necessarily done. And I think when you think about Omicron, there are very specific characteristics to what happened in this exact wave. First of all, we certainly were not investing at a federal level in a huge way in rapid at-home testing, but also rapid at-home testing has really fallen outside of, it hasn't really been, say, like insurance. It hasn't been their responsibility in the past. They don't pay for that typically. So there wasn't an obvious mechanism for us to get a lot of free rapid at-home tests onto the market. But the U.S. government wasn't in the background necessarily building up that industry the way they did support the drug makers in making the vaccines. And so what happened with Omicron was this combination of both, we didn't have the investment in the downtime, but also we had labs that were just short-staffed because the people were sick with Omicron. So then a lot of people were seeking tests through these labs, and therefore there was just a crunch in the lab space, and people were running to get these at-home kits, and they weren't around. Not to make any excuse for it, it's just to explain that there were a couple different dynamics at play, and it was a stress test, and the system clearly failed. So what the government is trying to do now is they're putting programs in place. But what they're really trying to game out and what test makers really want to see is a long-term strategic plan, because nobody wants to build a factory and let it sit for 3 years, 5 years, 8 years waiting for the next thing to come along. That's just not sustainable. They really need the government to help make that possible. Otherwise, we're just not going to have tests when either the next wave of COVID hits or the next.
Yeah. Well, Cynthia, that's what I wonder about, because there's also an expiration date on these that I've noticed, at least with the take home test. So it's like I have some tests sitting in.
Tim's been stocking up. Don't let him kid you. He tells me when they're like they're on sale. Well, get them here.
Well, look, you're bringing up two really important points, Carol. One is that I think that it's not that this kind of sneaks up from nowhere.
Yeah.
But there's like a colossal shift in demand. Right. It goes from sort of like you see these tests available at the pharmacy to then, you know, a week later, there are none in stock. Right. That was my own anecdotal experience. But they expire too, Cynthia. So what is the line that these companies and the government have to kind of cross in order to create enough, but not too many, and also just not have to throw them away in a couple of years if they indeed expire, which would actually be a great scenario because we don't need them.
Right.
Well, I think ultimately it is going to be come down to a question of how comfortable we are with buying too many, because ultimately I don't think we can decide, oh, there's some sweet spot. We really don't know. I mean, Omicron and what potential future variants could do in terms of just the exponential spread. I mean, it's really eye-opening. And so I think the idea that we're going to run the risk of making too many and throw them away, that's probably going to be what has to happen for right now, because I think people really want to have some comfort. But then there's also the other reality within the diagnostic space, and we didn't quite get into it in this piece, but we sort of started to hear more about, like, what could these platforms be used for, and, like, what could these businesses do longer term so that hopefully COVID does go away soon, and then they're looking at having platforms that are available for other types of tests that they could do instead, because we can't expect hundreds of millions of COVID tests to be churned out indefinitely there. But I think for the near term, probably we might have to just err on the side of oversupplying the market for a short term. But then longer term, like, how do you keep these businesses sustainable, and how does, say, our federal regulators make it possible for these companies to be able to pivot with the type of technology they're using so that they can have, say, testing platforms and they're able to plug different types of tests into them and then sell them that way?
You know, another thing that I thought was really interesting that your reporting illuminated, Cynthia, is this thing about not only is there sort of a dearth of tests here, but there's even a dearth of testing manufacturers if you compare it to the EU. Why is that? Why does the U.S. have so many fewer manufacturers?
It's interesting. So the U.S. FDA is known in some sense to be quite conservative, and that's one thing, it's a reputational thing. However, there's not necessarily, it's kind of interesting in that it's not clear to us whether or not maybe the FDA is slower than the EU regulators or their standards are more stringent. But I think what ultimately is happening now is the FDA is also recognizing that that's not going to work. So what they're doing actually is prioritizing test makers who can come out of the gate and make a lot, which is an interesting strategy. It disadvantages startups and young companies trying to get into this space who may not have the infrastructure, but it certainly points to they're starting to triangulate. It's not just about the science and the test. It's, of course, about that. They definitely don't want this to get anyone to get anything wrong. But I think they're also sort of weighing that in context of, like, what companies can do. So maybe we don't end up with that. The EU has tons of different test makers. We may end up with fewer, but fewer that could do a higher amount of production, at least near term in the beginning. But certainly the EU has moved faster and gotten a bigger variety of tests onto the market. And I really couldn't say for sure exactly what that's down to, although I do know that the FDA has really picked up the pace. And if you look at the approvals since October, it's picked up a lot. So I think it's definitely speeding along here now.
Well, it's so relevant to where we are today and the importance. Everybody who comes on, certainly from the medical community, talks to us about testing, testing, testing. It's really important and to have that access. Hey, guys, thanks so much. Cynthia Kunz, U.S. healthcare reporter, Bloomberg News, part of the team that put together the remarks in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. You can catch it on the Bloomberg at Bloomberg.com and also on newsstands later on this week. And our thanks to Joel Weber. Hear more from him later up in the week. He's editor of Business Week. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week on Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, less than 24 hours from now, we will have had the first FOMC meeting of the year, a meeting that has investors on edge again about how aggressive the Fed will be in reducing the liquidity in the system. We've got a great voice on this. So glad he's joining us once again. We're talking about Steve Skanke.
Steve Skanke is a former U.S. Treasury and White House National Security staff member, also chief economic advisor at Keel Point. Okay, Steve, always great to have you with us, and we're grateful that you join us before these big meetings. What is going through a Fed official's head right now, given the volatility that we've seen, not just in the last 2 days, but really since the start of 2022?
Yeah, well, first, thanks for having me back. It's always my pleasure to be with you, Carol and Tim. Any Fed official who's got to be voting on the FOMC today and tomorrow has got to be thinking about the reaction when the minutes of the December meeting came out, and markets, which had thought they understood what the Fed was going to do and sort of took it very well, all of a sudden figured out that they were probably being more hawkish and thinking more hawkishly than the market had expected. And that's when this recent spate of volatility and market sell-off started, with markets, the S&P showing down 10% year to date at one point yesterday before it bounced back, and then of course markets were off again today, and we've had another bounce back. So the big question is, how does the Fed convey what it is they want to do to combat inflation without creating a chaotic market environment? So messaging is a very important part of what they're thinking about and how they describe it. And what, if anything, do they want to say about letting their balance sheet run down later in the year, which was part of the discussion at the December meeting, which really didn't come out until the minutes were released earlier this month.
I feel like, Steve, it's kind of one of those things, those discussions you have with your kids or something, like, we'll see, like, we'll wait and see. We're data dependent. We'll wait and see versus, all right, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. Like, we know the Fed is going to start raising rates. We know liquidity is going to be taken out of the system. Done deal, right? The hawkish comments, they did the dirty work in the December meeting. Do we get the specifics, do you think, about March? Probably a quarter of a point. Will we get that specificity from Jay Powell and company tomorrow?
We certainly would expect to get that specificity. Either he's going to say we're going to do it in March or we're going to wait and see. It's really hard to imagine how they can wait and see with the December unemployment and inflation numbers. Headline inflation, CPI up 7% for December, PPI up 9.7% for December. Obviously lower at the core rate, 5.5 for the CPI, 6.9 for the PPI. But you know what's really interesting, and this I think confounds the Fed's deliberations a little bit. When you drill down into it, product prices were up 7% on a core basis in December, but services were only up 2.7. Mm-hmm. It really goes to the supply chain disruption,
yeah. Right?
And how retailers and even manufacturers are dealing with the COVID-related disruptions of getting their supply chain going again.
Hey, Steve,
think about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, because, you know, I know that the Fed's dual mandate, it's about stable prices and maximum employment. It doesn't include anything about propping up markets. And whenever I say that, Carol gives me this look, because they're obviously looking at financial markets. Help just take us into the decision-making process here of a voting Fed official, and help us understand, you know, how they look at market volatility and how they understand their decisions will be interpreted by the markets and how they make decisions based on that.
Well, certainly they care about public reaction and market reaction. Obviously, their mandate is to do the things that you said, price stability and full employment in the economy. And they're out to do that irrespective of the near and longer term impact that has on financial markets. But they care very much when the disruption to financial markets is about messaging or as a result of how it was communicated. And what we saw on January 4, when the minutes came out, is it was all about communication. Yes, there was a comment that they were talking about but hadn't decided anything on letting their balance sheet run off, you know, which was also part of the Chairman Powell communication issue in December 2018, when he said something about liquidity, and oh yeah, and that means that we'll be reducing liquidity as our balance sheet runs off. Well, that just caused markets to explode. And so interesting that we have the same issue,
right,
triggering market volatility and a downdraft as a result of how the Fed communicated this.
Well, you like
want to do the.
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, well, you know, you like so many others. I'm looking at the research points that you sent with us. You know, the good news, historically, equity markets continue to perform well after the Fed rate hikes begin, with the bull market running maybe another 3 to 5 years. That's some of the research you shared with us. We're hearing that because we cannot lose sight that there will be economic growth, fingers crossed, you know, that there will be corporate earnings, just maybe not as dynamic as we've seen. Gotta run. Steve, thank you so much. A voice we turn to when it comes to all things Fed outlook. Steve Skanke, former U.S. Treasury and White House National Security Council staff member. He is, of course, chief economic advisor at Kiel Point. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
I'm driving in my car.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody. Just got 10 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. Bouncing around, definitely off our lows of the session. We've seen major equity averages move into the green. Not holding there, though, with just a few minutes left in today's trading. You heard Charlie breaking down 47 on the S&P, 52 lower on the Dow. NASDAQ, your underperformer, down almost 2%, a decline, Tim, of 272 points. Our next guest we talked to over the holidays.
Oh, it's such a fun one.
But the cost of the 12 days of Christmas.
Yeah, you got to wonder if the Fed is thinking about the cost of the 12 days of Christmas.
And the other 353 days.
Yeah, exactly. Wait. Oh, wow. Good at math, Carol.
Thank you. Yeah.
I'm very impressed.
That's
okay.
What happens.
I was about to correct.
Econ major.
Wow. Okay. We're talking about Amanda Agati, the Chief Investment Officer at PNC Asset Management Group. She joins us once again on the phone from Philadelphia. Amanda, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you? Thanks.
We're doing well. Yeah, just really trying to make sense of what is going on in the markets. We did see the S&P 500 ever so briefly reach the green a little earlier in the day, but it's now down more than 1.1%. The NASDAQ down, as Carol said, more than 2% right now. How do you explain what's going on here?
Well, how do we make sense of the insanity?
Key
objective here. I mean, I really, we believe strongly that the market is just really struggling to reprice a rapidly evolving macro backdrop. And it's really catalyzed by a complete 180 in terms of tone and behavior and potentially policy shifting coming out of the Fed. Their messaging in December was notably different and a lot less patient. That is, they're very focused on withdrawal of policy support and at a much more rapid pace than I think what market participants were expecting. And so the market is really struggling with what exactly does that mean? What does that look like? And so hopefully we will get some more clarity and clues out of the Fed meeting tomorrow. But I think at the end of the day, in the absence of a lot of clarity, the market is just really struggling in this higher volatility regime to figure out what that path forward looks like. A rising rate backdrop, and a sustained inflationary backdrop, both really significant headwinds for market multiples.
All right. Having said that, market multiples have come down from where they were, considering the corrections that we've seen on a lot of those major equity averages. When you look, and you do look, at a lot of, Amanda, a lot of the technicals within the market, whether it's the S&P 500, whether you're looking at market breadth or the Russell 2000, we've been watching small caps in a big way too. What do they tell you? Have we bottomed out? Has capitulation happened, or not quite sure yet?
Well, the technical backdrop is definitely suggesting that we're reaching fairly extreme levels. When you look at moving averages, when you look at breadth, when you look at relative strength, they're all really pushing it in terms of extreme levels. That being said, it's hard to argue that we've necessarily reached a bottom here, although I think, you know, the finish yesterday was particularly interesting given how far down the market fell over the course of the day and then managed to eke out some very small gains. You have to think that sort of 10% down technical correction, if not textbook level correction from the all-time highs, certainly was a trigger there in terms of a little bit of stabilization. But until we get better clarity around what the path forward for Fed policy is going to look like, I think the market's going to chop around.
All right. I know, Tim, you want to ask a question, but I'm just going to say, we know what Fed policy, we don't know the specifics, but we know the Fed is going to start raising rates. We know it's not going to be such an easy monetary policy. We kind of got the dirty deed done in December from the Fed, did we not?
Well, we got some of it.
Okay.
I think it was very unexpected, certainly. But the pace of change, I think, is a lot more than what the market was suggesting. And so, you know, in a backdrop where growth is starting to slow, that is, we're passing the peak in terms of a number of economic indicators that we track, as well as earnings growth, that slower growth dynamic here is not necessarily the ballast that we need when the Fed is going to immediately pull the ripcord and withdraw policy support. So a number of rate hikes potentially here waiting in the wings early in 2022 here. And then the key question, too, is how fast do they actually start to taper the balance sheet? Those are two fairly significant headwinds for market multiples. And, you know, it's hard to argue that even with the pullback we've seen in the market, that really any aspect of the market is table pounding cheap. We're at really extended levels in terms of valuations. And so in that dynamic where there's multiple headwinds from a macro and from a policy perspective, doesn't leave a lot of shock absorber or headroom for the market to adjust. And so in the absence of, you know, more specific clarity or even slowing in terms of that policy shift, I think the market's just going to struggle here and be choppy here for a bit longer.
I do, Amanda, want to go from macro to micro, because it's not just the Fed that we have meeting this week. We also get earnings from some of the biggest companies out there, including Apple, Tesla. Microsoft is happening in just a few minutes. We're going to bring that to you live on Bloomberg TV and on Bloomberg Radio. What are you looking to hear, Amanda, from these companies to help get an understanding of how they're taking into account perhaps a rising rate environment, but also supply chain challenges and what that could spell for the greater market? I mean, Carol made the point earlier in the day, Microsoft's a really big part of the NASDAQ 100, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500.
Yeah, we could really use some beats and raises out of some of these big bellwether names for the index. You want some stabilization, those heavyweights will certainly do that if they beat and raise. I think the single most important catalyst for the markets in 2022 is not necessarily the Fed policy clarity, it's actually supply chain normalization, because that impacts so many aspects of not only earnings growth, but GDP growth, and certainly the inflationary backdrop. And so we really are going to be watching very closely for guidance in terms of how much more pain is left there. Are we starting to work through the challenges? Are we starting to get some stabilization or not? Because I think that really is going to be the key to the path forward. If we can get supply chain normalization, we actually think the inflationary fire will start to fade a bit from the backdrop, and perhaps make the Fed's job a little bit easier than where they find ourselves today.
Right. I do think about that in terms of that dual mandate. We know we've got kind of, for the most part, check in the labor market, although there's certainly pockets, minorities and others, that are still struggling in terms of improvement. But if inflation comes down, that would make it a lot easier for the Fed to not be maybe so aggressive. Amanda, so great to talk with you again. Amanda Gatti, she's Chief Investment Officer at PNC Asset Management Group, on the phone from Philadelphia.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.